Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour has spent the last 20 years of his career guiding over 4,000 young people, over two-thirds people of color, over half from disadvantaged backgrounds, into leadership positions. And his own story is quite compelling. He was a juvenile delinquent, kicked out of grade school, treated for drug addiction, barely made it out of high school, and yet rose to become a major nonprofit leader, social entrepreneur, and presidential advisor. And he highlights other people in his brand new book, Everyone Leads, who have similar stories. Our guest this hour is Paul Schmitz, and his book is Everyone Leads, Building Leadership from the Community Up. He is CEO of Public Allies, which advances leadership to strengthen communities, nonprofits, and civic participation across this country. He served on President Obama's transition team and the White House Council on Community Solutions, and he speaks frequently on social innovation, civic participation, diversity, and community building. The book is filled with really inspirational stories about people who were just down and out, very little self-esteem, but very smart and just had to be finding the right place to exhibit their talents and have their talents blossoming, and a leader who saw the potential blossoming in them and helped that to happen. Paul also happens to be from the Milwaukee area and wrote his book, I think, while he was sipping coffee at a Milwaukee establishment. So we're happy to have him with us. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Hello, Paul.
Hi, Kathleen. Great to be here.
Yeah, great to have you here. You know, it is amazing. I want to start with your story because your story is not all that unusual when you look at people who have become leaders and public allies. Who would have thought, you know, that you would be where you are right now when you looked at where you were as a young child? How did you get to be from somebody who was so down and out to somebody who has risen to where you are?
Well, I think that I can tell you that when I was younger, even as a young adult, I could have never imagined that I'd be doing what I'm doing now. And for me, it was a lot of relationships and people who believed in me even when I didn't believe in myself, people who stuck with me when I made mistakes not necessarily supporting those mistakes, holding me accountable for them, but helping me move forward. And I think that it was supportive relationships that really pulled me through. Frankly, I had a lot of help. But for me, I think the big thing is once I started getting engaged, I think part of it for me, and I write about this in the book, is that there were moments, even though I was got into a lot of trouble growing up, there were moments when I did get involved in positive things and really loved it. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that was something people could do. And I think that's one of the lessons that led me to build Public Allies and do the work I do now, is there's so many people who want to make a difference, but they have no idea how to go about doing it. And I think that it's we need everybody, and we need lots more people to find that leadership potential within themselves and step up.
That's what's so darned inspirational about the book. And you tell the stories, in addition to talking about leadership, of people who all of a sudden, they've been ignored, and that we really need to look at leadership in the places where we haven't been looking.
Absolutely. I begin the book with a couple interesting stories. I mean, one is a young woman who was a single mom at Milwaukee Area Technical College. She was 19 years old. She had a three-year-old son. And in her own words, she knew she was smart, but she had no idea of her potential. And Bizinesh went on to work in an organization here locally where she was working with teenage boys to help them get through high school. She got re-inspired in her education. She went on to Marquette University, went to University of Michigan Law School, a very successful career in law. Actually, I'd lost touch with her and got in touch again when she won a community service award at her law firm in Washington, and we got a large donation as a result. Today, she's head of presidential personnel at the White House. Most people don't look at single moms at MATC and think these could be White House lawyers.
Right.
The other story I open with is another great local story in Milwaukee, which is Peter Hoffel, who was working at the What's Fresh Deli on Juneau Street. He had a philosophy degree. He was concerned about social issues, would spend a lot of nights with his friends drinking beer and arguing about politics and social issues, but he never saw himself as part of the solution. And one day one of our staff went in to hang a poster in his deli, and Peter was thought that's exactly what I've been looking for. And today he heads the National Alliance for Mental Illness in Milwaukee and is a great advocate in our state and in our county or city on disability rights issues. And again, most people don't look at deli workers and think that's the leader who should be stepping up for our community. And what we found is there's just so much talent out there and that can be connected and that we need to connect if we want to solve problems in our community.
So let's talk a little bit more about public allies. You recruit those people, people who we overlook, diverse young people who do have that passion within them. And then what do they do?
Yeah, so we have a very selective process, and it's interesting because we get about 7 applicants per person we select each year. But we don't select people based on credentials or grades or things like that. We grade them on their passion and their commitment to this work. And so we've been able to find a lot of unusual people. And once they come into the program, they work full-time for 10 months at a local nonprofit organization, where they have some project they're responsible for with measurable results. And that could be at a local youth center. It could be working with people with HIV. It could be doing public health promotion. It could be building community gardens. There's a wide variety of work they can do, depending on their passion. And then one day a week they're with us, and we have an intensive leadership development curriculum we guide them through that really helps them build their leadership values, which we think is the most important and fundamental part of leadership. And our curriculum actually at this point, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee actually gives our participants a semester of undergraduate credit for completing our training program. That's the level of rigor that these Friday trainings have. And the goal is to build this network of leaders who are committed to a lifetime of working for community and social change. And we do this not only in Milwaukee, but in 20 other cities across the country. And currently there are over 600 young people in the program, I think 30 here in Milwaukee. And as you mentioned, we have over 4,000 graduates, and next year, our 20th year, we'll pass 5,000 graduates.
And you talk about the book. One of the chapters in the book looks at the theoretical heart of all of this, and I want you to talk more about the definition of leadership, which is connected to America's democratic history and particularly to our movement history, the civil rights movement.
Sure. Well, we define leadership in 3 ways. One, we think it's an action that everyone can take, not a position few people can hold. And that's perhaps the thing that's new about what we've brought to the leadership discussion, is that it really isn't about what your position is. It's about what you do. And people can lead in their homes and their communities on the cause that they care about. They can lead from positions of power. They can lead from the grassroots. And we see that even if we look at the Arab Spring or the Occupy movement or the Tea Party or other efforts. Leadership can come from all kinds of places. The second part of the definition is it's about taking responsibility, because the fundamental act of leadership is assuming responsibility, and it's to work on a common goal because you're working with others. And the third part of the definition of leadership is it's about the values you practice that make people want to work with you and make them work effectively together. And so we think it's about the action, the responsibility, and the values. And you know, the simple quick-hand way we also talked about this is the leadership of the many, that social change has always come from the leadership of the many. Yet our history always celebrates the heroic stories. We're always looking for the heroes. Mm-hmm. But in reality, if we look back through history, and I'll use 2 of the examples I use in the book, and we all talk about the amazing work the Founding Fathers did in Philadelphia, you know, conceiving our great democracy in our country, and they were courageous. It was a heroic moment, and we remember a few of those people. But the reality is our revolution was started in Lexington and Concord by farmers, blacksmiths, and free slaves. It was Captain John Parker, a farmer, who organized this ragtag militia to take on the most powerful army in the world. We don't remember him, nor do we remember all the other people who stepped up across the colonies, because it's not like they issued a proclamation in Philadelphia and all these people suddenly appeared. there was leadership at all levels that brought people up. And it was really the leadership of the many, including women and free slaves and all sorts of people, who created the revolution. And it's not to diminish the power and inspiration of our founding fathers, but to say that it's half the story of the leadership. And if we take another moment in our history, in the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, and the amazing I Have a Dream speech by Dr. King, which was truly a transformative moment in our culture and our country. But we don't often think about how did he, you know, how did that happen? And the reality is a lot of people don't remember A. Philip Randolph, who was a mentor of King's and probably the leading civil rights leader at that time, who organized the march, who called the march and brought all the groups together, and Bayard Rustin, who was the organizer who pulled it together in 7 weeks to organize 200,000 people and transport them and house them and feed them and have sanitation and organize the event, all of that in 7 weeks without Twitter, without Facebook, without email,
right, right.
Without a website. It's unbelievable when you think of the task. And the New York Times had a great article a couple weeks before the march, just marveling at what Rustin had put together because he had spent decades building networks of leaders across the country. And the week after the March on Washington, after King's speech, Life magazine had a photo of Rustin and Randolph on the cover, not King, because they were the ones who called and organized the march. But again, Dr. King's leadership and inspiration shouldn't be diminished. It's just saying, again, that heroic moment's part of the story, but it's not the full story.
Right. And even
the full story was that there were leaders at all levels, and the civil rights movement throughout its history was the leadership of the many. And I think we get stuck too often thinking about the heroes and remembering the heroes, and then it relegates everyone else who stepped up, everyone else who led, to kind of pleasant background music, as I say. And we forget that it always has been, if we look at any moment in history, it's always the leadership of many people at all levels. And that's what we need today to solve problems.
Because it was also King who took responsibility and said, sure, you can meet at my church, right? When
right.
he was not a leader then. I mean, he became one because he took responsibility.
Right. And he was a 26-year-old preacher. And at the time of the Montgomery bus boycott, the reason why they picked him initially to be a spokesperson was he was the youngest preacher. They thought he was a good speaker. But they also thought if he got ran out of town, it wouldn't be as much trouble because he didn't have a family yet. And even that moment I write about in the book, because, you know, we all remember Rosa Parks, again, an unbelievable, courageous, and heroic moment. But it was Joanna Robinson, who another woman in town, who went to the local NAACP and suggested the bus boycott.
Right.
And it was people who stayed up all night, 15,000 flyers in one night, getting out to women throughout the community to stop them from taking the bus. It's the leadership of the many.
So tell me just about the funding of this. Are you part of the AmeriCorps program, Paul?
Yeah, so Public Allies was one of the original models for AmeriCorps. We were actually first funded under the first President Bush as a demonstration project for national service. And we've been recognized and supported as a model of national service under the last four administrations. And what that means for us in terms of funding is that about a third of our funding nationally comes from AmeriCorps, and the other two-thirds comes from private sources. And so we match every public dollar with more than $2 in private resources, which is something that most AmeriCorps programs do, which is kind of neat because it's a real public-private partnership where you're supported by your community, but you're able to leverage some additional federal funds to support the work. And so, and that money supports these young people so they can get a very modest stipend in health care and child care, so they're able to do this work full-time. And it's what allows us to bring in a lot of people and give them access. You know, over half of our participants go on to college or graduate school at the end because they get this opportunity, and it really gives them a pathway to education and careers. And I should also just mention that over 85% of our graduates are still working in nonprofit and public service. So it really is a ladder where we've developed thousands of people who are still serving their communities. And so a modest public investment has generated years of service among a lot of these people.
Similar to people who are in the Peace Corps.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There, you know, you look, you go through Foggy Bottom in Washington where the State Department is, and it's filled with people who had Peace Corps experience. I think that the reality is that when you give people that formative opportunity, and for us, we really do connect it as a ladder to a career in public service. We've been able to seat a lot of leaders into this space that our communities and our country need.
Yeah. So when you look at all of your applicants, and you have too many applicants, a surplus of applicants for the public allies that you can help along, what are you looking for? Are you looking for people who really have had extraordinary struggles in their lives and you just sense a passion in them and intelligence about them that makes them somebody you can take a chance on? Because in some cases, you look at these people and say, whoa, we really have to take a chance on this, like somebody had to take a chance on you.
Absolutely. And so, you know, I think that for us, I think the beauty is we try to find, I think there's three things that define an ally class. The first is that we look for people who have that core passion. This isn't just something they want to try. It's not like they want to do a year of service and then do something else. It's not that they have, you know, that they're people who have a real fire in their belly to make a difference and want to know how to do it. The second is we look for the leadership values. We look for people who don't think of leadership as being directive to others, as being in charge, but understand that leadership is about being able to facilitate. It's about being able to work with others collaboratively, to include others, to be a learner, to have be responsible for what you say and do and hold that accountability. We look for leaders who share those types of values. And then we kind of ask ourselves, what uniquely did this person bring to the group? Because one of the beauties of it is when you have Ivy League graduates and young people with GEDs in the same program, the learning is incredibly remarkable. And what happens is their conversations about issues, their knowledge of community is multiplied by everyone else's experience. And so by having people who come from different neighborhoods who are engaged on different issues, whether it's education or health or economic development or the environment, people who are veterans, people who are have disabilities, by having that mix of people and mix of perspectives, it creates a very powerful learning experience for everybody. So we do look, not everyone has to have had struggles, but certainly there's some people who've had some substantial life struggles, but there's other people who have had a normal path and are exceptional also. And so we try and really just create that mix. And as I said, the beauty of it is that mix is a really powerful place for them to learn.
We're going to go to phone calls for our guest. Paul Schmitz is our guest this hour. His book is Everyone Leads, Building Leadership from the Community Up. Paul is the CEO of Public Allies, and they advance leadership to strengthen communities, nonprofits, and civic participation across the country. They have recruited and have trained a number of people since the program started, and people who are unlikely leaders, but maybe we're all really unlikely leaders. He's trained over 4,000 young people. Some are Ivy League graduates. Some have their GEDs. Many are from disadvantaged backgrounds, and trains them into leadership positions, and then they work on a whole host of issues important to the community that they are serving. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. We'll have you join us in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls. Sandy in Madison, our first caller. Hi, Sandy.
Good morning, Kathleen. I really love your show. Thank you so much. And I appreciate you and your leadership in drawing people out, and the way you interview people. It builds trust.
Thank you, Sandy.
And my question is, when I first heard what you were talking about today, is what I was thinking of yesterday, was the question, what is leadership? What are the qualities? What are the characteristics of good leadership? And as I'm listening, I think you've already answered it.
Well, thank you for your question. I think that what I would add to that, and I think, it, you know, I touched on it a bit before, is this whole issue of values. And one of the models I talk about in the book that I found interesting is the Army model, which is divided into three parts, be, know, do. And the concept is that first you have to understand who you are as a leader. What's your mission? What's your purpose? What are your values? How do you work and negotiate those values and your experience with others? And you have to master that before you gain the knowledge and the skills to accomplish your mission and your purpose. I think too much leadership development at schools and in organizations and others focuses on the knowledge and skills to do a job and not on the values, not on the B space. We believe that leadership development is almost all in the B space, that it's about building values that make one somebody that people want to work with, that people can follow, make us also people who walk our talk. And we offer a set of values we think are most important for leading in our communities today. For us, there are five. One is the ability to recognize and mobilize all of a community's assets. We think leaders are people who see, even we look at people and communities as both, as all being half full and half empty. Every one of us has skills and talents that make us great family members, friends, workers, leaders. But we all also have shortcomings, and as I always joke to my audiences, if we ask their lovers, ex-lovers, older siblings, younger siblings, and others about their shortcomings, we can get a list for everybody. So we all have both. And I think a leader is someone who, despite seeing the shortcomings of an individual or a community, is able to look and see that fullness and able to recognize how to connect that fullness. To us, the first value that's so important is the ability to recognize and mobilize assets. And then we think that inclusion is absolutely important in our increasingly diverse communities. The ability to facilitate collaborative action, to really, the core work of leadership is working with others. The ability to be a continuous learner, someone who is constantly learning. And we think leadership is often about having the right questions, not just having the answers, and that leaders are constantly seeking feedback. And finally, it's integrity, being accountable to those you work with, being accountable to those you serve. And we think that all of those are the values that are important today, but we think that the qualities that are important are all in the value space. I think skills can be learned, and I think values can be learned and developed as well. But I think we spend too much time focused on building competent leaders and not enough on building contemplative leaders.
Hmm. Well, that's a nice phrase. Thanks, Sandy, very much for your call. Eugene in Viola. Hi, Eugene.
Good morning, Kathleen. I have a personal story to tell, if I could, please.
Of course.
I quit high school. This is nearly 55 years ago. I quit high school when I was 16. I had a teacher throw me out the door and threw my coat after me and told me not to come back.
Why did your teacher do that, Eugene?
I just wasn't behaving myself.
Ah.
But what happened was a couple of years later, I decided I wanted an education. And I went to a plant in southeastern Wisconsin and got hired. And I looked around, and I thought I could do things better than that. So I made arrangements to work at the plant there and go to high school days. I spent 2.5 years doing that. Then from there, I went to normal school, County Normal at Viroqua, and I starved to death for 2 years. The jobs were good at the time. I could have stayed in industry, and I just didn't want to do it. And when I got to normal school, I had a lot of people around me helping me, giving a lot of support, and I figured I owed them something. Then I saw a few things, and I started taking on the projects that didn't always work. I took on the projects that weren't the greatest, but I always kept trying, and I think I got that tenacity to try from my mother, because when us three boys were growing up, our mother let us do about anything, but she never told us one thing. She never told us we failed, and I also decided I wanted to make a difference in the world when I finally got a degree, and I figured out another thing, too. You don't quit, and I always tell young people this: try the projects that won't work. Just give them a whirl, and you're going to learn more than you're going to lose.
Thanks, Eugene, for your call. Paul.
Yeah, amen, thank you. And I think that, again, that's so often the story. And there's a woman I write about in the book, Malia Dicker, who is this high-performing young woman throughout her whole life, straight A's, always did the right things, and she got to adulthood, got in this community experience, and realized she didn't know how to work with other people effectively. She'd never learned how to collaborate. She'd never learned how to take risks. She'd always focused on just achieving and playing the achievement game. She then went back and redid her schooling from kindergarten through college, spending 1 week in each level in the classroom she was in and writing and blogging about it. And it was called Reschool Yourself. And one of her insights was, she said, all these people when she was growing up that she thought were the troublemakers, were stupid in her thought at the time, because they didn't get it. When she went back and looked at them again, she realized they were the smart folks. And I think that so often, again, it's just when we focus too much on credentials and not on credibility, I think we lose a lot of talent. And Eugene, I would just encourage anyone. We have a website, everyoneleads.org, and there's a share your story section. We invite people to come and share stories like that, Eugene. So I would just welcome you to do that as well. I think your story is very inspirational. Thank you.
Yeah, well, that's a good idea. And tell me a couple other stories, because the book is filled with stories, and I want to spend just a little bit of time before we go back to phone calls talking about the work that some of the public allies are doing. And if you don't mind, if you got your book in front of you, because you got so many stories, the Stepping Up for Youth, Reggie Moore and Charlin Bowen Moore, who work in Milwaukee, and there are a lot of Milwaukee stories because you're from Milwaukee, but the work that they have done to put together the Milwaukee Youth Initiative, I think just think we need more samples of what's going on, the work that's being done, the leadership.
Yeah, well, Reggie and Charlin are phenomenal leaders. I met them when they were 18 years old. And I've known them for quite a while, and I still think of them as young people. And I hope they still think of me as a young leader too. But we've known each other for quite a long time, and you know, they are just incredibly young people. They started an organization in Milwaukee called Urban Underground, and I think what's exciting about Urban Underground is they get literally hundreds of young people a year apply to be in this program that maybe does 30 to 50 young people a year through a leadership experience. And we've hired a lot of young people out of this program. It's really incredible. And I think what's interesting, I'm just going to, I'll take a moment just to read a little bit about their background.
Sure.
Because I think it just shows how leadership emerges from all sorts of impulses. And I write about how they got an early start. Charlin Bowen, an immigrant from Jamaica, had an accent and struggled to fit in at school. Then one day in fifth grade, she noticed an Asian-American girl being teased and defiantly stuck up for her. She took the next step of asking an art teacher if they could do something at school to celebrate diversity. A cultural fair was created, and from this crucible moment, Charlin grew into an advocate for other youth. Reggie says his inspiration started at home. My mom ran our house like a community organization. She had strong faith and practice it by helping other families in the neighborhood, inviting homeless people in to shower and eat, providing food and tutoring to neighborhood kids, and demonstrating generosity in spite of how much or little we had. That example inspired in Reggie a commitment to practice his faith by helping others at a young age. No one ever told me I couldn't. I was blessed to meet positive people throughout my life who encouraged me even against the odds. Regardless of age, I see confidence and competence as both important. And if you have the confidence behind your purpose, you have to do what is necessary to build the competence to do it right. Reggie and Charlin met in high school and participated in the YMCA's Black Achievers program. They immediately discovered a common commitment to helping other young people. After graduating from high school, they began studying education in college and created the Urban Outreach Association, where they recruited their peers to teach life and leadership skills at middle schools and high schools. Recognized their talents and tenacity, I helped hire them to work for two different nonprofit organizations where I served as a board member. And I go on to talk about Urban Underground, which started when we had this cruising issue in Milwaukee and the police arrested all these young people. And, of course, they had nowhere to go. And they created this forum that brought community members, the police, youth organizations, and young people together. And they've spent the last 15 years or so really bringing the voice of urban youth into the public square. And what we find, again, is just how incredible these young people are. And again, it's all this talent. And I think that for public allies, you know, what we found is lots of leaders like Reggie and Charlin. And I'm happy to share other stories too, Kathleen.
Yeah. Plus, they got married, right?
They got me.
I know.
I never knew they were a couple, and then they, at their graduation one year, he proposed to her, and everyone kind of was shocked because they had kept that secret. And I think that's just the power of their integrity. They never wanted that to become an issue. And but they're just a phenomenal couple of leaders here in Milwaukee that I have greatly admired for years.
I'll have to get them on the air. I don't think we've had them on. Eugene, thanks for the call. Cody in Oshkosh, hi.
Hi, I like your idea that people are working for positions rather than what they actually do in those positions, and I think that is more important. I wonder, in our education system, if there wouldn't be more opportunities to allow students to get into service-type learning as opposed to traditional classes, and what your thoughts are on that.
Hmm. Yeah, I think service learning is a very powerful thing, and you know, sometimes I feel like the conversations around education only happen on Lake Wobegon, where we're focused on the idea that everyone's going to be an A student. And I think the reality is that people learn in different ways and get motivated by different things. And service is a powerful motivator, and we've seen great evidence that service learning, it builds character, it builds skills. And the idea of service learning is it's not just service, it's connected to learning. So kids do an environmental project where they're using math and science. They do a program on hunger where they're actually doing measurement and data. So the idea is that they're using service as a lab for their learning. And I think it can be just a powerful motivator. And again, we need to build character and social and emotional skills as much as we do intellectual skills. When we look at the cynicism about leadership today, it's mostly about leaders not practicing what they preach, or not being inclusive, or not sharing values. When we look at what we're concerned with in society today, it's often that not that people aren't smart enough, it's that we don't trust their character. And I think that's why we need things like service learning, so that people can really build that side of the leadership.
Thanks, Cody, for the call. Paul, how did you get on the presidential transition team?
So, I mean, and I tell the story in the book. Back when we started Public Allies, this young Chicago organizer named Barack Obama was on our founding board. And when the Bush administration gave us money to open our Chicago office, we wanted to hire his fiance, Michelle Robinson. And people always say, during the campaign, people kept asking us if Barack Obama used his influence to get us to hire his wife. And it was the opposite. We used his influence to get her to take the job. I had been a telemarketer in an insurance agency, was a student at UWM. She had a Princeton and Harvard law degree. So getting her to work with us was a much harder thing than anything else. But she was a phenomenal leader, and Michelle and I worked very closely together, and she was a mentor of mine. She was one of the smartest, most professional and caring and wisest people I've ever worked with. And she got me involved in the campaign early, and I worked on I co-chaired a policy area of the campaign that focused on issues of nonprofits and social innovation and civic participation, and built agendas around that. Part of that became the Serve America Act, which was probably the most bipartisan bill passed, in which it was the one bill that Senator McCain and Senator Obama during the campaign did a joint event to endorse, which was a wonderful moment. And we, and so from that work, I was on the transition team and have stayed an advisor and a member of the White House Council on Community Solutions, where we are focused on how do we connect the 6.7 million young people right now who are disconnected from work and education to job and career and educational opportunities. And we just did a big event January 5th, and at www.serve.gov/council, you can learn about the work of the White House Council. And Michelle just has been a tremendous influence on me at a young age. And again, I was working as a telemarketer, and you know, at the time that I started running Public Allies, she had already had a career in law and worked for the mayor and had a law degree. And so I would just drive down to Chicago all the time and just copy whatever the heck she was doing. And so she really is someone I've long admired and looked up to. And I tell her story, and she has quite a long quote in the book about what she learned that that's, I think, one of the most inspirational parts of the book.
Mm-hmm. What about those 6.7 million young people? When you say that they're disconnected, what are they all doing?
Trying to make ends meet one way or another, right? Mm-hmm. So what we found is about half of that group is chronically disconnected. Mm-hmm. So half of that group, have not within, I think, the previous year either been employed or in school. The other half have been at different points connected. And the thing is, when you have no safety net in your life, it's easy to get knocked out.
Mm-hmm.
And so if a sibling dies suddenly, or you have your home gets foreclosed, or what have you, that when there's no when the bottom falls out for a lot of these young people, it's hard to stay in. And we've seen that with so many of the young people we've worked with, where things happen that can completely just undercut and derail them. And I think that there are a lot of good organizations and programs that figured out how do you create those connections. And what we have to do is get more young people into those paths. And the other reality is we know that education is going to be more linked to careers, and we've got to help people stay in school once they enter. And so there's a number of things. And our council created an employer toolkit that was created by leaders from the private sector to look at how they can better employ some of these young people that often need a little bit more support to get into the workforce and get going. And in addition to that, we are developing this idea called collective impact, and partly modeled on Milwaukee's experience with our dramatic reduction in teen pregnancies over the last few years that the United Way and City of Milwaukee have led. But it's this idea that how do you get organizations to stop all working independently and really work together to try and drive community-level results? And so the United Way of America actually has partnered with our council and is launching efforts in 30 communities right now to begin talking about how can we create systems among the organizations and services that already exist that can better be coordinated to really connect more of these disconnected youth back into education, work, and other opportunities, and get the services they need to help them when they have those challenges along the way.
Yeah, great. Nancy in Menasha, hi.
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 This is a great show. I think there's so many people that you're probably reaching who have some type of passion for something, but they really don't know how to go about igniting it. And so instead, we just get caught up in our usual daily lives and end up not doing anything, or maybe volunteering for this and that. But so I think you're probably really touching a lot of people today. Two other things. One, do you ever? I know you're basically working, it sounds like, with young people, and I can understand that because you want a long commitment with all of the work and the training that goes into this, and for the good of the society. But do you ever consider people who are older and maybe retired from a career who could give you 5 years or something like that? Would that ever be considered?
Nancy, thank you for your question, and absolutely. I want to kind of hit the two things you stated. One was about how people can get started. I think leadership, in a way, is a muscle, and it can build, and we have to start small. You don't start bench pressing 200 pounds, right? And I think we can all find ways, whether it's in our home, in our community, or on a cause we care about, to step up and get other people involved. And it's often those small steps and a victory there that lead us to then take a bigger step. I was in this town in Florida a couple weeks ago called Edenville, which is the oldest African-American municipality in the country. And everyone kept talking about this one, Miss Dinkins. She was 97 years old.
Oh, my.
She has never missed a city council meeting. And she picks up people to drive them to the city council meeting. The mayor hosted this lunch with local community leaders with me, and everyone deferred to this woman. Now, she has no position. She has no role. She's just a concerned citizen who's heavily engaged. Mm-hmm. And everyone sees her as the leader. She has no, but she's never had a position of formal leadership in the community. It's the birthplace of Zora Neale Hurston, where she wrote her books, and she helped spearhead the city, really making that its claim to fame. But in meeting this woman, I can tell you that she's never witnessed a crime either, because you look at her in the eyes and you realize if you're doing something bad and you're near her, you see her, you run away. But so I think that, again, I think we could all start. And, you know, I asked her how she got started, and it was just a small church group she had joined was her first step. And it wasn't that she started by creating something big. She started by participating in a church group, and that led to some issue that she got involved with more, and she started going to council meetings, and she started speaking up, and her leadership grew. To your second point, there's a group called Civic Ventures that has been working to build all sorts of ways for older Americans to get involved, including things like Experience Corps, which is actually an AmeriCorps program for older Americans, as well as other programs and efforts, and this concept of an encore career, that we know that people are living a lot longer than they used to. They're productive a lot longer. And yes, you have so much to give because you know people have more energy than older Americans had in generations past, and they have more time. And finding ways for people to plug in is really important. And I would encourage you to look into the work of Civic Ventures and things like Experience Corps and other efforts. So they created a thing called the Purpose Prize, which actually gives these large awards to seniors in America who've made a big difference and who started making their difference as seniors. And so there we need, you know, when I say everyone leads, we need everyone. Public Eyes program is really geared towards young people, and the work we do is geared towards helping people begin careers. But I think our interest in improving communities extends to all generations, and it takes intergenerationally. We have to work together to solve problems.
Well, thank you. And then I just want to ask you one more quick question. Are you ever in search of nonprofits for your people to work with? Because I feel I have a really good one in Chicago that I know of, but I don't know if it's appropriate to get
well,
into this conversation.
Well, if you go
there
to the publicallies.org website, please contact us about that, because, yes, we place over 50 young people a year in Chicago, and we're always looking for organizations to partner with, and so that would be wonderful. I appreciate that reference.
Publicallies.org.
Yes.
Thank you.
Great, thanks.
Thank you.
What about broadcasting facilities? Do you place anybody in those areas?
You know, we in the past we were able to place people in a wider variety of placements. Right now, AmeriCorps has focused as part of the new bill. They really wanted to focus the impact in the areas of education, health, and economic development and environment on very specific outcomes.
I see.
And so we actually have had people in public broadcasting places where they're doing educational programming and outreach, and so sometimes we have had opportunities like that we've been able to do when we've been able to find that link to the kinds of results we also have to demonstrate for our federal resources.
More phone calls in a moment. Paul Schmitz is our guest this hour. Paul is from Milwaukee, actually, and he founded Public Allies Milwaukee in 1993. He's been the national CEO of Public Allies since 2000. He is the author of the just-released Everyone Leads, Building Leadership from the Community Up. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. You can send an email if you'd like. That is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to phone calls, let's go next to Ann in Platteville. Hi, Ann.
Hi. Thank you for allowing me to ask my question. When your guest was talking about people who are one sort of step away from disaster, I was reminded of foster kids, many of whom age out of the system and have hardly any support for them. So the question is, do you do any work with the programs that help to support foster kids, or do you ever try to encourage others to start those kinds of programs?
To us, it's an important population, and we both do service in projects that work with young people in the foster care system. We actually had a national partnership with the Alliance for Children and Families where we worked in many cities with that population. We've also recruited a lot of people. We've got a young woman right now, Freya Wilson, in Washington, D.C., who works for a program called Best Kids, which mentors young people who are in the foster care system. And Freya is someone who went through the foster care system, aged out 18. She's a mother of two. And her boss said about her when I interviewed him that she sees signals none of the rest of us see. And I think the power of having people from that experience. And in the book, I tell the story of Giselle John, who grew up in the foster care system and was aging out in August 1999. She was on a path to homelessness when she discovered Public Eyes New York and was selected to begin the program in September. She said, Public Eyes was the bridge between the foster care experience and a professional path that kept me from being out on the streets. Giselle put her experience and leadership to work by serving as a program director with Youth Communication, where she worked to empower youth in the foster care system by helping them find their voices and share their experiences and skills with the community through a youth magazine and other media. More important, she found her calling. I decided that I wanted to devote my career to working with other kids in the foster care system. After graduating from Public Allies, Giselle continued to work with youth in the foster care and juvenile justice systems while completing her bachelor's degree at John Jay College. Now she is serving as a consultant with the Annie Casey Foundation's Family to Family Initiative, where she provides technical assistance to reform foster care systems in Kentucky, North Carolina, and Ohio, and empower the young people who are in the system. Her inspiring story has also been featured in a book with a foreword by Jimmy Carter about young people in the foster care system. She said, because of Public Allies, I do work that makes me excited to wake up every morning. I'm making a huge difference for young people who are just like me. And, you know, I wanted to share that story because Giselle is just a tremendous young leader. And, again, it's just to demonstrate that even in the foster care world, there's an immense amount of talent. And we've been fortunate to hire a lot of just really amazing young people from that world.
I'm glad you asked that question, Ann.
Well, me too.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. I do have a comment, and that is I wonder how we as a society can change our viewpoint. I've dealt with youth, and I've so often heard people recounting that so-and-so's a failure at age, you know, 21 or at age 19, and I keep saying, no. I mean, you know, all of us have to fail at those ages. We have to fail at every age. Mm-hmm. It's way too early to make that decision, but it keeps going on and on and on.
My only response is amen.
Mm-hmm. How true.
I mean, we can't do that to young people.
Right.
And you know, if there's anything about America that makes it great, that makes us exceptional, way it's that it's always been the land of second chances.
Mm-hmm.
And we've always been the place that people can rise up through adversity, through challenge. And I think that to label anyone at any age a failure, you know, Abraham Lincoln had been labeled a failure many times. Steve Jobs had been labeled a failure both at school and after he was fired from Apple. You know, there's so many famous examples of failures that we could spend, you know, hours just talking about all the famous examples of that. And I think you don't need to be famous to recognize that. That's not a great way to define people, and that this is a land where everyone can kind of take that second chance or that third chance and sometimes fourth chance, but we're a land in which people can overcome their struggles and challenges and past failures to succeed.
Thank you, Anne. Glad you called. Mary and Eau Claire, hi.
Hi. I have a question. We talk about leadership, and everybody wants to be a good leader, and that's good. And I really admire the service ideals that we're talking about here. But I think we need to talk about followership. I mean, we're going to be followers, like the private in the Army in one way is a leader, but mostly the private is going to be a follower. No, that private has probably gone through a discernment process, like one of the last callers said, about finding his or her calling. But
well,
I think that links the two is the concept of belonging.
Mm.
Yeah, I think that you know, it's interesting when I talked about the Army model, and one of the reasons why the Army is probably the biggest leadership development organization on the planet is because of their core belief that every single soldier has to be both a leader and a follower. And situationally, it will differ, but everyone has to be prepared to step up. And I think that the concept of everyone leads does not mean everyone should be in charge. It doesn't mean there shouldn't be hierarchy. It doesn't mean there shouldn't be rules or structures. We need all of that.
And on that note, we got to let it go.
Appropriate for different contexts.
Give us the email address or the website, Paul, because we have to say goodbye.
Sure. The website for the book is www.everyoneleads.org.
Okay.
And it includes information on the book as well as places where people can share their stories of how you've stepped up.
Wonderful. Thank you, Paul, so much. Paul Schmitz, and he happens to be from Milwaukee. Many of you, I'm sure, know him. The book is Everyone Leads, Building Leadership from the Community Up. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the show and for on-air production. Thanks for your calls.